I'm Malu Singoro from State Law Advisor's Office. I'm Malu Singoro from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
I'm Ismail Hussain from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Development was mainly driven by mining, and we see the contribution to GDP of the sector and the employment level of around 500,000 direct employment, and obviously the multiplier effect of the mining industry. And we see there the market capitalization of the mining industry around 80% in stock exchange, and the variety of mining activities that are taking place in the country, mining gold, platinum, group metal, manganese, coal, diamond. And the last few points, just contextualizing the nature of operations we have in South Africa, just starting from the bottom, low-risk surface mines, which the intensity of low-risk surface mining operation increased through the introduction of the MPRDA in 2004. And we have a growing medium-risk mechanized base metal and coal mines, and then the high-risk, large-deep, labor-intensive gold and platinum underground mines. And when you look at that area, that's where a lot of our problems in terms of safety and health in the industry come in. Because when you look at mining around the world, South Africa is the deepest mining country in the world, with the inherent problems that come with mining at those depths. Because the deeper you go down, the warmer the rock becomes. So without ventilation, without pushing ice down the shaft, you run with temperatures around 60 degrees. And there are issues of confinement also. And I've made the point there with labor-intensive industry employs, it's highly labor-intensive. And in those confined environments, high levels of exposure to risk because of the depth and the problem of seismicity, because the deeper you go and you're mining, the pressure builds up, and it is released in the form of seismicity. Any earthquake underground which leads to a lot of faults of ground. In fact, when you look at our history of mining, well over 50% of our death in the mining industry is due to faults of ground. So that's just the profile of the sector. And then the next slide just shows us the problem with health, because often we talk about safety, and health is one of the biggest problems, and you don't see it immediately. What we fail to do now in terms of health will see the consequences in 8-9 years. The problems we see now are problems of 8-9 years ago. And we can clearly see there on the slide, the blue being TB, and then the brownish one being silicosis. And I think we have two, lighter and dark brown, the other one being noise-induced hearing loss. So the biggest problem in the mining sector in our country in terms of health is noise-induced hearing loss, people losing their hearing because of working in this confined environment and there's high levels of noise. And silicosis, because of inhaling dust that contains silica and leads to problems with the lungs. And then tuberculosis compounded by the problem of HIV and AIDS. So I was just putting that slide to indicate the problems relating to health. And the next slide talks to what the inspectorate, the department as a regulator, is able to do to improve conditions where there's low compliance or there are problems around health and safety. And this really gives the context to some of the amendments that were introduced in the Act. We see for minor breaches, inspectors are empowered in terms of the law, powers given by the legislature, to give improvement notices where you find that people are not complying. It's not very serious, but an inspector can say, give a notice, you need to improve conditions before you continue mining. And I'm saying DME there because there are different roles, other responsibility falls to the prosecution and the Department of Justice. And then for repeat breaches, when inspectors go and they find the same thing, the Act makes provision in terms of Section 55 for inspectors to issue administrative fines. And I'll talk in detail about administrative fines because that's an area where we're making an amendment. And also, in serious cases, where an inspector goes into a site and he realizes that if I leave the situation as is, people will be injured or even killed, an inspector is empowered in terms of Section 54 to stop operations, to stop the work in that area, or to stop the whole mine until the employer or owner of the mine has corrected the situation. So that inspectors can take. And in terms of serious injury, if a person is injured, then there must be an investigation. And that investigation may lead to prosecution or may even lead to a fine. And that's why we have a star at the Department of Justice, because if there was clear negligence, and then those investigation reports then are referred to the Department of Justice to take further action. And then in case of death, have to conduct an investigation, and after an investigation, conduct an inquiry. That inquiry can either be a joint inquest inquiry, where we do it with the prosecution, and then it's referred to the justice to take the action. So broadly, these are sanctions or actions that inspectors can take to ensure that corrective actions are taken where they non-compliant. Now, the following slide talks to a number of these things, just giving figures for the last 3 years, just to have insight of what inspectors have been doing. When you look at improvement notices that you can see there for minor breaches, improvement notices, the inspectors headed by the chief inspector, we've got offices in all the provinces, in each province. We have an office, and the office is headed by a principal inspector, and with inspectors, and they visit the mines in that region. And we can see the notices, the number of notices issued. We just went to the annual report and extracted the figures there to see what inspectors have been doing. We see there in Gauteng, 289 improvement notices in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2007, and 207, 208. And we can see how the different provinces are performing with regard to this. In some provinces like Western Cape, which are not big mining regions, you can see the numbers being low. And it's very interesting when you look at these figures, because currently with the increased drive to enforce the legislation that we've seen in the last year and a half, we've noticed in provinces where this is done, accidents are starting to come down. However, in provinces where probably inspectors are not very much inclined to take the action, you're starting to see the accidents probably going up. But we can see the performance of the inspectors, the totals at the bottom, and then the next one is the administrative fine. Section 55 of the current Act, where inspectors go and they find that they've given instructions for improvement and the employers are not improving conditions, then they can give a fine. Currently, that fine is it's limited to a maximum of 200,000. And that's where we introduce an amendment. Dealing with the mining industry, it's a multi-million industry, and that amount of fine hasn't served as a deterrent for non-compliance. And I think when I talk to it, I'll talk to the details of why it's been a problem. And we can see there that, let me just outline the process. When an inspector goes to a site and he realizes that there's a problem that merits a fine, he recommends, in terms of law, recommends to the principal inspector. The principal inspector will look at the report, the performance of that particular waiting place or mine, and on the basis of the evidence before him, he will either set aside or confirm that recommendation and tell the mine that you need to pay a certain amount. And we can see how the different regions have been issuing. And in general, when you look at the slide, you can see the very low level or low numbers of fines that are issued. And I'll talk to the technicalities and problems around the administrative fines and why they are mentioned. In 2005, in total, the entire sector was fined $674,000, and the value paid collected very low, $100,000. And I'll talk to the problems surrounding this. Same 2006 and 7, same thing. Almost a million fines, only half a million collected. And for that year, the collection was much better because a lot of the monies collected were coming from the previous year. And then 2007 and 8, increased enforcement action. Pumalang are leading the way there. And we see 3.3 million. Fines issued, and then only a quarter of a million collected for this year. And then the other action that inspectors can take is to stop working places now. Move. You go into a place, dangerous, you realize if I send my vehicle to this situation, somebody will be killed. And we see how the different regions have performed for the last 3 years. And the general regions, particularly in the bigger mining regions like Gauteng, Free State, Northwest, the conditions that inspectors find, poor thermal conditions. I've alluded to the problem of heat when you go deeper. The geothermal gradients, the rock gets hotter. Unless you have refrigeration plants, separators go 60 degrees, then people just die because of this stroke. So inspectors find those conditions in these provinces where there's no proper ventilation, temperatures are very high, dangerous gases, no methane, you can't smell it, you walk into methane, you're dead, just immediate. Airborne pollutants, spoken about the problem of silicosis. The dust has silica in it, which will lead to lung disease later. Poor ventilation, poor reading, dangerous use of rolling rock, poor explosive control. We've had accidents that relate to explosives, and we can see currently in the country ATM bombing. So explosive control is a big problem in some areas. Unguarded machinery, failure to use protective clothing, PPE, and support poor mining practices. And if I can just talk briefly about that, because during the time when our gold mining sector was shrinking, gold price was low, a lot of ground was left underground, which was deemed not to be payable, not making business sense. But now with the high commodity prices, people are going back to those areas they had left behind. And because it's a pillar, you've left the pillar 3 kilometers underground, there's a pressure build up on that pillar. And that's why we have the seismic event. And it's important, support is very critical to those areas. These are some of the areas stop to waiting places because they find that no proper support regime. And then you look at the Cape region, Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Northern Cape, there's a thousand people are waiting. And generally in this area, smaller operations, people use machines with pulleys, and those pulleys are not guarded. If you're wearing a loose hanging overall, that machine pulls you And then the predominantly coal regions in Mpumalanga, in Popo, growing platinum area, KZN. Also similar problems around conveyor gunning of machines. And because it's mainly a surface operation, sometimes you find that people are doing deeper holes without thinking properly about the possibility of these walls falling. And so those are the general areas, legal problems that we have sometimes in those areas. And then this is just a summary that talks to Section 54. That is the stoppage order. That's the power of inspectors to stop working places. Now that we've been problems for the past 3 years, and we've seen the collection of fines, a very low level of fines that are collected. And now switching to regulatory capacity. Because you can have the best legislation if you're not able to enforce it. The same as not having the legislation. And the actual challenge here is that the mine inspector is a very specialist inspector. You need engineers, you need mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, mining engineers. And we all know that the country is facing a serious scale of challenge. And now what is happening is people who've been inspectors for years are going back into the industry because the industry pays them 3-4 times what the public sector is able to pay them. So you're sitting with a serious problem. In 2006, the inspectors were standing at about, at the end of the year, we had 38 vacancies, and mainly the technical field engineers. 2007, 76. And as we speak, I'm running with about 92 vacancies, 82 of those vacancies in the area of technical fields. You have some major mining regions where currently we don't even have machinery inspectors who are able to go look at engineering installations to make sure that people are not exposed to it. So that's the regulatory capacity, and we'll talk about the amendment to address the growing challenge of capacity. And often when you present statistics around capacity, the next question you have to answer is what are you doing about it? Are you advertising? What are you doing? And here I've just given an indication. For the past 27 months, we've advertised 283 posts, and we spend about 3.2 million just advertising. Many of these adverts you advertise, you don't even attract the double candidates. And it shows in the different disciplines, particularly engineering, you're not able to attract. In the area of health, it's much better, you're still able to get people, but engineering is a big problem. And we started to employ people on contract who are not fully qualified. And the challenge here is that an inspector is a judge. You expect him to go to the mining site, pass judgment on people operating. So they have to know, they need technical skills to be able to do that. So we employ individuals with relevant qualifications, and we put them on a training program to try and get them ready to be appointed as inspectors. But invariably what happens when they qualify, they leave, they go back into the industry. And these are just percentages. Mine equipment, 50% of the advertised posts were filled. Still 85%. In the engineering, mechanical and electrical engineering, mine surveying, we're not able to fill the post. The individuals who are there are close to retirement. And it's a very, mine safety, that's engineering, only 36%. So we are able to fill medicine at 100%, and hygiene 81%. Similar statistics. Okay, this is a quarterly report that goes to the minister, just interviews that are held with individuals who are leaving. And these are some of the reasons actual site for leaving the department and going back to the public, in the private sector. And the biggest chunk, 42%, people related to remuneration, problems around supervision and management, 27%, lack of career path, 26%, and other conditions. What we've done in the last 2 years to try and address the problem was to develop a strategy where we approach National Treasury and said, we have a serious problem, unless we deal with the problem, we won't have an inspection. And we requested some money to take bazaaries, to give bazaaries and say, if National Treasury said it's a new idea, and they gave us only $500,000, and we managed to recruit seven students who are currently at university. I must stress there, that's a long-term intervention. You're looking at 8 years to get those people coming into stream and then. The middle one, number two there, intervention, we started what we call a learnership program, and we call it internship program there, but you're taking graduates and diplomats, and we've entered a service level, into a service level agreement with Gold Fields Academy, where we put them there for 2 years for experiential training. We have 23 learners currently, the 1 year there training. And there you're looking at about 4 years to turn that individual into an inspector material. And then the top one is continual learning of the existing inspector. So this is what we would be able to do within the confines of the public sector. The numbers could be bigger, but the public sector is not just set up to do training the way we think it should, given the problem currently. So this slide really gives us the context, and members will realize when I go into the amendment bill now, a lot of these amendments seek to address the problems that we have highlighted in the presentation. And if I can just give a background, the health and safety in South Africa was regulated by the Mineral Act, Mine Works Act, and then Mineral Act, which was promulgated in 1991, if I'm not mistaken. And then the big mining disaster in Val Rift, where 104 miners were killed when the shaft fell down the shaft. President Mandela at the time set up a commission, the Leon Commission, and Judge Leon said the Mineral Act was inadequate to address issues of health and safety. In 1997, the Mine Health and Safety Act was promulgated, and it's 10 years, over 10 years now, that is implemented the act. And we think we've learned to see what sectors are with, what areas we can after 10 years of these are key areas, amendment areas. I think I don't know if members have the amendment bill, the copy. We've captured them in the slides in the sequence that you have here in the amendment bill. So section 2A, not a major amendment, it's simply there we're requesting the mine, it's an amendment that requests the mine to inform us when they appoint the CEO, because it was pretty voluntary in the previous, in the act. They didn't make it a requirement to appoint CEOs, and the mines were not required to really inform us. And sometimes it creates a problem. We had a major incident 2-3 years back where 9 people were killed in Rustenburg, and we didn't know who to talk to, that is the operator, because there's measures and everything. So you don't know who they are coming officer. And that section requires mines when they appoint the chief executive officer to inform the chief executive of that appointment. Section 10 deals with the very critical issue in the sector, the issue of health and safety training. In many investigations and inquiries that we conduct after injuries or death, employers will say, we have trained the individual, he knew, he shouldn't do it. And the individual is dead, he can't speak for himself. When you say, where are the records of training, those records don't exist. So that section is saying to employers, when you train, you must have the records, you must keep the records of that training. And it's our belief that if health and safety training is intensified in the sector, to teach employees of their right to refuse to work in dangerous workplaces, it will go a long way in improving health and safety in our minds. Because inspectors, as you've seen, the numbers dwindling, and the issue of covering is a problem. So inspectors tend to go to bigger mining establishments where there are problems, and there are times where they are not even able to go to it. So if training is intensified, you are able to contain the problem of health and safety. And the other section, which was, I think I'll highlight, they introduced the CPC letter, which I think is very critical and important, and it was probably an oversight from our side. MQA, the Mining Qualification Authority, was established as a CEDA in terms of the Mine Health and Safety Act before the Skills Development Act established CEDA. And it plays a very critical role in health and safety training. And what we find is that there's very limited training takes place in terms of health and safety. And we introduced a requirement there that mines must submit their workplace skills plan, the annual training report to the MQA, which will help the inspector to see that that training takes place at mining operations. And then section 11.5 introduces time frame. That section deals with when an accident happens. In terms of section 11.5, employers must conduct an investigation. In terms of section 60 of the Act, the government through the inspectors must conduct investigations. These are separate investigations. However, what happened, there were no time frames. These investigations sometimes were never concluded or investigated. And effectively, the change we were introducing in that section was to say that the employers must have that investigation, and it must be concluded within 30 days of the incident. And we believe that there's tremendous value in doing this, because a lot of our accidents are repeat accidents. I think I've highlighted in my the beginning that over 50% of our deaths in the mining sector are caused by falls of ground. And really, if these investigations are done properly, widely shared, some of these things that are in this accident. And then section 13 is a fairly easy one. When the Act was promulgated in 97, in South Africa we didn't have qualified occupational health practitioners. And so the Act was passed with a provision that allows mines to appoint general practitioners to deal with matters of occupational health. Now, in 10 years, people have been trained, universities are running programs on occupational health, and we think even the problems we've painted of occupational health, we think it's time now that qualified professionals deal with the worker health in the work environment. And we amended the section there to require mines to avoid occupational mental things. And then section 17 deals with exit medical. This is a big problem. Members may have seen in the last 4 years people staying in markets at the Department of Labor and at the Department around issues of compensation. But people get sick at operations, and sometimes they are sent home without any exit medical. And when they get home, they are sick. They are not compensated. And what that section doing is saying to the employer, if somebody's services are terminated, then you have to do an exit medical within 30 days. Because that exit medical is to check that this man or woman has been working here, has he contracted occupational illnesses, that we qualify for compensation. So it's really to close that gap, that people are not sent back to their community with illnesses, which eventually leads to their death without qualifying for compensation. And then Section 20 also links to some extent with Section 17. It kept dismissal pending appeals. When doctors at mine find that somebody, an individual or an employee is ill, sometimes they can declare them unfit to work at the mine. However, Section 20 allows the worker to appeal that finding to the medical inspector in the department. But the problem here, what happens while the employee appeals, the mine lays the employee off. And then it really becomes a problem. So essentially that section is saying if an employee appeals, you cannot dismiss them until the appeal is canceled. So that's what the section says. And then section 23 of the current act empowers mine workers to refuse to work in a dangerous place. However, the general feeling is that employees are victimized if they realize that the working place is dangerous and they say we can't work in this place. They are discriminated against. And what that section is doing is just seeking the minister's guidelines, minimum guidelines of how you deal with the situation, how the employee refuses them, how really just to protect the employees from discrimination. And then section 41 to 44, Mine Health and Safety Act, section 41 introduces a council. The current act, there's a council, Mine Health and Safety Council, which we call MHSC. And the function of that council is to advise the minister on occupational health and safety. An advisory body. It's got 15 members, 5 members from the industry, 5 members from unions, and 5 members from state departments. And they meet on a quarterly basis, look at health and safety trends, and advise the Minister of Minerals and Energy. When the Act was introduced, the Council was not envisaged. It was not envisaged that it will be a public entity. It was purely just an advisory body. But with growing responsibility, there was some administration work going there because we conduct research under this Mine Health and Safety Research under this council. So we were funding it to a tune of about $3 million a year. And in terms of PFMA, any institution that gets public funding, the Minister of Finance can declare it a public entity. And that's what happened in 2003. So Pantel became a public entity, and the whole governance issues came to the fore. And it creates a problem because it's a very small institution. So all you're doing the whole year is planning and trying to comply to legislative requirements. And you have committees that serve under Council. Safety in Mines Research Advisory Committee, which really oversees mining research. You have MOHEC, which is Mine Occupational Health Advisory Committee, which deals with health issues. And you have MREC, Mining Regulatory Advisory Committee, which deals with changes to regulations. Because when the Act was promulgated in 97, we didn't repeal the Mineral Act regulations, which regulations were heavily criticized in the Lyon Commission because basically the feeling was that it was regulations written in blood. What happened over many years, somebody died and you sit down and say, you're killed by a rope, thou shalt not use a rope. So that's how this legislation was written for many years, and it's a big chunk, I think chapter 35 chapters. And so we've been reviewing old regulation. So EMBREC was doing that way. However, the problem here with the declaration of council as a public entity, you had subcommittees that operate under council, which their statutory duty spelled out in the law. And now with governance issues, when you ask committees to do certain things, then they will go back and say, we can only do this, this is what the law says. And council has wrestled for a number of years with qualifications because of the governance arrangement. And what we're doing here is really to improve the efficiency and governance of council by deleting all the functions and taking those functions and making them the functions of the council, and council will then delegate them to the committee. Just like in a normal board, the board runs the responsibility and it delegates to the different committees. And those section 41 to 44 really just do away with the functions as stipulated in the act and makes it the functions of the council. And then section 47 establishes the mine health and safety inspectors as a juridical person. And there was a lot of discussion around this issue, both with the minister, the director general, in view of the capacity constraints that the inspector is facing. The thinking was that it would be better to use this vehicle, this public entity council that exists, to house the inspector there as an entity of government. It reports to the minister, which will allow it flexibility to deal with the capacity constraints to inspect and regulate. So section 47 establishes the inspector as a juridical person. And then section 49 and 49A, having an inspector as a juridical person, establishes certain functions, and it just outlines the governance function of the inspector. Section 50 talks to the powers of the inspector, which was extended at the CPC, and I think I've received the note, and I think we are told having a letter also from this member of mine. I think at the PPC there was an introduction of a section there that says where there's a health threatening incident or serious injury, the inspector must stop the operation. And I'll talk to him later because I think we have practical problems with that section. But that's an amendment. And then section 55 is a section that deals with administrative fines. I've presented the slide of how many fines were recommended and the low level of collection. Very few monies are paid from this administrative fine. And if I can give a context to what really is the issue here. In 97, when the Act was promulgated, section 86, I think subsection 3 contained a section that said that if a person dies at a mine, then the manager or the employer is guilty until he proves otherwise. And there was a big debate in the country about the constitutionality of that section because it goes against South African constitutional tenets. And the law was promulgated without that section. And at that time, because this act was driven by the council itself, tripartite institution establishment, they were given a mandate then to say, come with an equally effective sanction that will serve as a deterrent to non-compliance. And that's where Section 55 was introduced, the whole fine system. And because it was developed in an environment where the stakeholders, the whole procedure was written into the act of how you issue a fine, you appeal, and it literally, if you do it by law, it will take an inspector 3 months to finalize the single fine. And it explains why, if you look at the levels of fines, inspectors were not very keen to issue fines. With a capacity challenge you have, you're sitting with a problem where you're writing this fine, lawyers are appealing, and it just creates a lot of administrative work because of the procedure written into the act. So what this section is doing is to remove that procedure from the act, simplify the fine system. If there's non-compliance, you issue a fine, you give them a time to make representation, and within 30 days they need to pay the fine. And the fine is increased from 200,000 to 1 million. Because we're dealing with a big industry, and unless people realize that there's a cost to non-compliance or to not improving conditions, there will be no motivation for them to put in mechanisms to protect the health and safety of the employees. And then Section 58, the old Act said any dispute in terms of this Act must be handled by the Labour Court. And because of the low level of, in fact, we don't have a lot of case law around health and safety in the country. Cases are referred, they are never done. Labour Court never really handled issues of health and safety. So when we amended the Act, we thought we probably need to elevate the issues to the higher court so that we really lead to the development of health and safety law in the country. But with public comments, people strongly felt that the Labour Court is starting to work and it's important, the case is much better than Labour Court. And I think what we did at the PPC, they were deliberating. But we, however, with the state law advisor, it was an omission from our part. We failed to put back the labor court. And I think I'm highlighting it so that we put it back. Because I think the act has then simply sent to an appropriate court. And it may have plenty of problems. It's not put the big necessary letter to the specific court. Section 76. Introduces a section that gives the minister right to enter mines for health and safety reasons. And then Section 86 introduces the issue of criminal liability. And I think the attempt here was to strengthen enforcement. As I've said, cases are referred, and we're ready to try and create clear offenses so that you are able to deterrence for non-compliance, because cases are handled, they are sent to the justice, and then you have to hear anything after. And so Section 86 was strengthened. Section 91 was dealing with general offenses in terms of the Act. And currently the way the Act stands, you could only give a fine. And remember, the fine was simply 200,000 maximum. Could only give an employer a fine and prosecute everybody else. And what Section 91 is doing is removing that and making it possible to prosecute employers. Dealing with multinationals in this area of mining, and the way we see it, we think really if these big companies can come mine with impunity, it's really the disrespect for the sovereignty of the country. They are legal persona and they must carry responsibility like every citizen in the country. So Section 91 really deals with offenses, creates offenses also for employers for non-compliance. And then administrative fines, I think it relates to Section 55, it just increased from 200,000 to 1 million. And there was a table in the Act that stipulated offenses, and those offenses were increased. And the thinking really is, if you do this, then you have the Act that has teeth. The Mine Health and Safety Act, in our view, is a very progressive piece of legislation that introduces the concept of risk management. And the rest of the world is starting to go in that direction. Australia, 5 years. a law drafted in the law like ours, we're well ahead of the Americans who are studying this thing in terms of our law, but it was very weak when it comes to sanctions for non-compliance. And this is what they are amending sanctions, strengthen sanctions. And it's not intended to stop industry or threaten people from mining, and some people or some comments from the industry. But it's really what we said. I mean, I went to Australia, Queensland recently, and I had the privilege to meet the minister there, Jeff Wilson, and he talked about health and safety, and he said to me, you know, the very same companies that are mining in your country are companies that mine here in Australia, and they don't kill people like they are doing in your country. Why? And their laws are very strict, and they are really important. And we think that's where the problem in this legislation is really flexing the sanctions for non-compliance. It's aim at intransigent employers. It's not aim at people who are trying their best to comply. It's people who are given instructions that they consistently don't want to comply. Our mining sector is killing a lot of people a year. Currently, as we speak, we've lost for this year 146 miners already for this year compared to 164 last year. The numbers have come down, but 150 is quite a high number to be losing people at that level. And my concluding slide just broadly looks at the sections that were introduced and that may have implementation challenges. Section 11, I think Section 11, when it was introduced, there were some immunity for asking the employers to submit certain reports, not every report. And currently, the way the section simply forces employers to submit those reports to your department. And I'm just saying, the problem is here that we're going to have to build a lot of archives. When you look at a year, well, just 1 year, we have around 4,000 injury incidents in the mining industry. Now, if we have to get all those reports, you have to build lots and lots of archives. And the quality of those reports will not be worth the paper it's written on. Because no one is going to tell you that somebody was killed because I didn't put support. If he knows that that report will go to government, and it may be used to prosecute them. It's not the same. We can still do the investigation, but that, I think, is an implementation challenge that we see in this section. Section 49, I think there was a section that was introduced very early in the amendment bill, which we needed to have taken out. It talks to the inspector developing an implementation plan for the whole action. It's not a very technical section, and it just come out. It was just an oversight just to come out. I think in finalizing the bill with the state law advisors, looking at the details, some of the things that have been corrected. And Section 49, very early when the amendment bill was prepared, there was a Section 49 which was requiring mines to get health and safety permits. And because of the capacity constraints of the inspector, the approvals that have to be done, we thought it would not be a practical section to implement. And so it was removed. However, under the functions, we forgot to remove that section that was pending. And we think the section that come out is not impacting the. And then Section 57, I think we talked about it, it hasn't got discretion. All it's saying is that if a person is crashed at the mine, the inspector must stop the mine. And we think it's going to be a very problematic section with being given spirit and comments from the industry around it. And we think it's duplicating Section 54. I've indicated that inspectors have power to stop working places to take that action. And that section is spirit. And there's no discretion for inspectors. Inspectors have to. And we think this is going to create think some of the sections repeat the matters I've already alluded to in the presentation. It's just clean up where the sections are too wide and with the advice of the state law, advice of the region. What was the issue with the subject matter? Or is it simply very broad? It says you're dealing with a set of facts and we think it should be limited to the subject matter when referring or dealing with fines and retaining of the labor force as touched on it. So I think that really covers the presentation. Section 54 is a duplication of what is in the FAJA Act, Public Administration. Okay. Justice Act. It clearly says people carrying out administrative functions and make sure that their actions are reasonable, fair, just, and allow people representation. And we repeat the same thing probably in the Act, and we thought just those sections on top of the representation, but the duplication of what is required. Because one of the reasons introductory notes to this amendment was to align the to existing legislation. Some of this legislation came after FAJA, MPRP, all of this Act was promulgated after the minor, and we are just aligning them. And so that brings me to the end of the presentation, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have had. I was going to suggest that perhaps before we get into discussions, we make sure we have the two copies of the bill, B-54 and B-54-B, because sometimes it becomes necessary to look at how was the bill formulated or how was the sentence formulated before amendments were proposed, and if these are adopted, what difference would the amendment bring to the sentence in the section? All that. Do we all have the two copies? Thank you very much. Now it is our turn to speak, but at least speak orderly. Thank you. Members, your turn. I see Honorable Douglas, Honorable Chen, Honorable Gamede. I think in the meantime, those are the only hands that have been up. And the Honorable Kulu at the end. So in that order, please, Honorable Douglas, your turn. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. I just want to get one question of clarity. The system of fines that is now applicable, is it in the new version of the world as well? Is that the current system that they offer? Okay, so I'm very concerned because, I mean, 600,000 for the entire industry in terms of fines is nothing for even a single mine to think of and make it continue going on and flooding the law, basically. What would be the solution to this problem? I know that you said there was one of the there was an original proposal which was ruled to be unconstitutional, but what does the department think would be the solution to this problem? Because obviously just imposing fines is not working and it's not going to work in the future, and how can that be encapsulated in our law? Secondly, and I'd like a proposal to hear from you so that we can, as a committee, maybe deliberate on it. Secondly, I'm very concerned also about the vacancies and the amount of vacancies there are, and then also the number of inspectors, because obviously the legislation is only as good as your ability to enact it and enforce it and to make sure that there is compliance to it. So my concern is what is being done to increase the number of inspectors. I know that you have mentioned some basic programs that you have going, but really there needs to be something more substantial. Needs to be something that can be done, even if it means becoming competitive with the private sector. I think those are my two questions. Then also on the health issues, is there an ongoing process now that we know the results of the last 7 or 8 years? We now can see what the main causes of health problems within the industry is. What is being done physically right now to adjust those problems so we don't have the same graph 7 years from now?
Part of my question being covered because I already got the question already. But furthermore, I can also see that this capacity has really become an issue. I think, as you mentioned about, doesn't matter how good a piece of law is, if we don't have the capacity to deliver, and this piece of law doesn't mean anything on that. There's something which I'm interested to know. I can see the department being trying very much to try to attract the skill process. But the reason, beside the reason you mentioned on your presentation, I just want to know, does this DEE's code of conduct also have impact because of this limit to attract the capable person to be in our department or not? In other words, it's supplement action. Certain posts for certain people and so on. Okay. Then in the implementation challenge, because I see on the item 4, which is on the section 49, we saying there because we don't have a capacity to deal with permit at this stage, and therefore we are forced to delete it. I'm a little concerned, because if this is a necessary mission which we have to deal with. And due to because of we have no capacity and we have to delete that, I would like to ask the department then, do we have any other alternative way to achieve what we are trying to achieve? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to minus some of the questions. But I have to start with the very important one. I think we're dealing with mine health safety. And in the presentation, I heard about diseases that are caused by working in the mine that even lead to some death. There are deaths in mines, and it was said plus minus 150 to date in mines. But in the whole presentation, I did not hear anything about the disability. That end up being disabled just because they work in mine. As we speak, I think just a week ago, I was called by former mine workers in Canton, all disabled, all housed somewhere. And they don't even get to be visited by these inspectors. They just left to fend for themselves. So what about this issue of disability? On slide number 6, I see in all those other slides, the notices are increasing, even in places where there are no mines, meaning not major mines. Then it says definitely there's something wrong, whether with the inspectorate or with the enforcement. So if you cannot have an area that has got 4 mines, but would get 20 notices this year and 60 notices next year, then there's something wrong. What does your research say? Why is the problem? Well, the issue of enforcement of payment has been mentioned, but even on stoppages, they are increasing also. Now, the question is, is it the old stoppages? 2006 will stop one mine. Would it be the same mine 2007, 2008? If not, if yes, it is a serious problem. If not, it is a more serious problem because you won't have new mines, more mines being stopped if they're new. So it's just a grave matter. Just a thorough explanation. Are these really the same mines that are being stopped? on the regulatory capacity, the staff issues and all that thing. Is there a plan ahead that you mentioned of retaining these people and training? I saw the training and development part. But what other incentives would make me as an inspector to stay? Is it the grading of the position? We cannot say we would match the private sector, but definitely we need to be doing something to retain this professional. What is the plan? And I see the figures of students that you have, 23, it's very little even for one province, let alone the country. I'd also like to know the plan. Then I've got one issue where I have a problem with, I think on the amendment of the bill, Section 11, Subsection 5, where would see these employers now doing an investigation. You know, I come from the holy province of KwaZulu-Natal. There are some mines there. There's formerly Tyco, which is Exxaro. And I've been trying to deal with the case there for more than 3 years. In one area where Tyco, as it's usually known, people have got a problem about this dust. And they've got the problem that ever since Tyco mined there, there's been water coming underground. Now, the problem I have is that the employer becomes the player and the ref. Now, you ask an employer who it is alleged causes this problem, then you request the employer to do an investigation, the outcome of which might find the employer. So if I'm asked to investigate myself and the investigation comes positive, definitely I won't come with that result. So it doesn't create a, you know, so I have a, you know, I'm not sure whether it's a personal problem, but I see it as being a player in the referee. I think it would have been far more better if the department or another person, because you need another structure to investigate. But outside this meeting, I'll ask you to, all of us, to revisit this matter about Tyco. It is a sore throat in our community there. So there's not going to be finance. Also on Section 47, the establishment of the MHSA, or have you talked with the Department of Labor? One government, one country. The state has got inspectors. Are we going to see a number of inspectors? And is there any synergy? Or they are going to be independent and it's not going to fight over terrain, thus delaying the process of doing the work. DOL will say, I'm coming for this. You'll say, no, you're not supposed to do this. I'll do this. Just to give some clarity on this. Thanks.
Thank you. Chairperson, mine is around the actual physical health for the people. The mention that in housing, the poor ventilation in housing contributes to ill health. And of course, we know that a person who is ill cannot work and concentrate properly, even mental attention is affected. And of course, we know that where there is poor ventilation, usually people end up by having TB. So now we are looking at prevention, providing good basic diet at work and in the home environment, and also to have immune boosters. I know at one time that the mining giants, like De Beers, were actually involved in the areas where the miners came from, like the Eastern Cape, KwaZulu, and Mozambique, where Mr. Oppenheimer was having a big sort of bus going about teaching about the planting and the use of soybeans so that people had a good foundation of immune boosting system where the miners came from, and also to make sure that the families themselves were healthy, and even when they went back to their homes, the miners could find good diet. Now, could then the mining giant again look at where the community, where the miners come from, and assist the provinces by improving the quality of food packages that are being given to the people to flood right now, as it is the, you know, the flooding season, and we know the economy is really going down, and people from the areas which are doing farming are the ones that fill up the mining houses. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nkulu. Oh, I can see Honorable Nkulu do want to say something. You can do so before I say one, two. Then you said only one question. If I was listening carefully to the presenter when he was making that comment, saying that the very same companies that are mining in South Africa are also mining in Australia. And the kind of incidents actually that are happening here in South Africa by with life loss, something like that, are not happening in Australia. And then I think that's what it has got my attention. For example, if you check slide number on page 5, slide number 10, the issues actually that are raised. And then one would ask himself that the kind of prevention actually that will be brought around in this new amendment will really be enough to show or to remedy the present situation that is currently happening in our country. And then secondly, I just want to get clarity around the responsibility of appointing the responsibilities of the CEO in the mining industry. Currently, what is their responsibility? Of which this bill actually suggesting that the department should be involved when the miners actually want to appoint the CEO. If the mines actually are informed around that matter, what will change the present situation in that mining in the mining industry? Thank you very much. I have two little questions. The first one, you indicated that you have the inspectors who have to go about checking the health and safety situation in different mines. And you stressed and emphasized time and again that these mining giants are multi-million, billion, I don't know, something like that. Now, you know, I just want to find out, is there a way in which the department grounds these inspectors not to be brought out of their duties when they enter the mine premises, because they may very well go there well informed only to find that some dollars and some pounds and some yens and a whole lot of those monies are just flying around them, and they may very easily tend to collaborate with the employers and not do the duties they were sent there for. That's one thing. Is there some grounding way in which the department is assisting them? But if it's just a question of picking anyone because he or she happened to be qualified, I don't know. The second question, when I look at these slides, number 8, the whole lot of them, where we talk of administrative fines, you have a section where we are told how many administrative fines were recommended, and a section where the administrative fines were set aside. What makes the recommendation to be set aside? Is it because it is not workable, it has to be improved, or it is completely so stupid that doesn't need consideration? What it is that makes a recommended administrative fine be set aside? Because I tend to understand that by setting aside, declaring it out of order, and nobody has to worry about it. what goes on there? And again, the possibility of the dollar and the pound or even the yen flowing around is not at play. Because definitely we need to be serious and be honest. These days, it is money that determines almost everything. So, as you said, we may have a lot of policies that are very good principles and a whole lot of them. But if the stomach is hungry, all those can very easily collapse. And we find people doing the very things we say they shouldn't be done. Perhaps the last, the last one. You talked about Section 10, where in the principal act or the original act there was a verb may use. And you said in terms of the recommendations from the portfolio committee, the word must was introduced, and you said you think it is going to create a bit of... Would you mind just going back to it and let's have a look at that? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. If I can... I thought I'd start from the bottom, but it looks like it's difficult to start. I will just address the questions in a sequence of arrays. My colleagues will assist where they can. If I just look at the question of the Honorable Douglas, the question was, what is the solution to the fine? The amendments that we need, and just a broad comment, because generally the question that came up, are these amendments adequate to really improve the situation? And we firmly believe that this amendment will help us to turn the tide. The biggest problem, the underlying problem probably is capacity, which Section 47 is trying to address. But when you look at the admin fines, what we've done was remove this whole procedure in the Act, because since last year, if you really notice, last year we started very strict enforcement around June, where we insisted on stoppage where conditions are bad, because there was just a general relaxation, I think, at the enforcement front. There are motivation issues with capacity issues and everything. Because when you look at the MPRDA, for example, which is one thing I didn't bring here, every single file that passes through mineral regulation passes through the inspectors too. So other than the inspection work, inspectors also have to do administrative work related to mining licenses. And you get motivation issues, and inspectors generally, a lot of them saw themselves as consultants, advisors to the mines. They didn't really take enforcement action in many instances. And we insisted, we laid out programs to develop policies and procedures as we speak, which touches on the dollar yen and an aspect to try and address those issues. Because the public, we've had this question from the AG to say, inspectors have lost of power. What are we doing to make sure that they are not because it can happen. So we've developed operational policies and procedures which interrogate. If they find a certain condition, they have to detail it in the report. If they haven't taken the action, they have to say why. And so those processes are in place to make sure that those instances, if they happen, they are dealt with. And our internal disciplinary procedure, where cases of that nature happen, we investigate them and deal with them in that particular way. And there are cases which we have to deal with where inspectors behave in an unwelcome manner, and they are reported to us. To address the problem, because they represent government, they are regulators, and they need to carry that aura and respect. But to go back to the Honorable Douglas question, our solution is we remove the procedure in the Act, which will make it easier as an enforcement tool. Inspectors will have to use it, and at the same time, we increase the amount. And remember, companies have to produce an annual report where their investors look at this report. And that's been part of the problem. Even with this 200,000, they didn't want to pay. Because in the investor fee that our company is fined for non-compliance, it becomes a serious issue. In fact, we're sitting with a situation where files and files of lawyers, even if you, because we've taken even a position to say to grant them, let's, in some cases, even you'll issue them 10,000 fine if it's not a serious issue. They will still pay lawyers 100,000 to fight that 5,000 because they are afraid that it will appear in their annual report. So our belief is that they increase to a million and we've removed this procedure which they were hiding behind. It's going to be very forceful in driving compliance and making sure that people comply. And touching on the issue of vacancy, I think in presenting ourselves, the public sector as it stands was not set up to deal with the current skill shortage. In fact, the training I'm running currently, I'm using savings because of vacancy. And in terms of CSMA, you can only buy them in a certain amount. So, because I'm not getting a budget that says there's so many millions to train. In fact, this program I'm running with both is costing us 4.5 million. If you look at the entire department budget, training budget, it's around 5 million. So public sector was not set up to train. Traditionally, when you look at inspectors, government depended on people who worked in the industry and they thought they could add value in a different environment. And they moved into the public sector. And now you're sitting with a problem that there's a skill shortage. Industry now is paying them much more than you are able to keep them. And so many of them are going back into the industry. And we're thinking that the entity route gives you the flexibility to deal with the problem. Because what I've seen many jurisdictions. Recently we've had the trip to the United States, we've looked at Queensland, UK. If departments are within, if inspectors are within government, because the problem with inspectors around the world is the same thing. Companies tended to depend on people who retire to become inspectors. In South Africa, the whole landscape changed. Whereas in 5-10 years ago, you were affecting retiring people from the sector, you're no longer getting those people. You're getting young people who just finished university who are looking for jobs. And in many jurisdictions, there are occupation-specific dispensations where you take inspectors and you develop a separate package for them. They've done it in Australia, Queensland, UK, United States. And that's what we're trying here. We've been talking to DPSA. However, DPSA has come with a lot of conditionalities up front. It's not going to work. You can't increase salary beyond this. You can't do this. You can't. And when you look at the at what is happening now, the honourable member Ian raised question around the affirmative action. Is it affecting not on reserving jobs for specific people? But because 2009 is a charter review year, also it's a driver. Industry is taking black professionals from government for their compliance with the charter and all those type of things, which is even further deepening the problem of equity, both in government and also the problem of skills. So there are all of these issues that are at play. And that's why Section 47, it was thoroughly discussed, and we thought in an entity setup, you have the flexibility to run massive programs of training. And other than those massive programs of training, you cannot match in a public sector context the salaries, but you can create much more flexible conditions of employment. Because a lot of these people that are leaving come to us. We've counter-offered some of them. They're getting much higher packages, but if you give them something, they're willing to stay. But I got to a point where we said we have to stop this because you're creating a problem in your structure. I employed Jelis this year. There's Gaza who's been there for 10 years. Jelis gets an offer outside. I elevated to 6 notches above Gaza. Tomorrow Gaza is complaining. And that's the problem we're creating in the structure, in trying to counter offer. So you're trying to solve a problem and creating another internally. So we thought the NCC route will assist us. And it has support of both industry and the union, because they are closer to the place and they can see the problem. And while talking about capacity, I think I've talked about training. Honorable Gumede raised the issue also around training, and that what we do is something, but it's little. It is really a public sector constraint. Even this year, we've requested money from National Treasury just to run with programs of training, and we were not able to get those funds. If I can move to the question of health issues, Honorable Douglas went out. I'll go back to it when he comes back. I think he raised the question. Let me deal with the permissions, the payments. Honorable Ian, the issue of payments was a new one. We introduced a whole section where we said to really, because you have a problem of coverage, if you have an operation running and you force them up front to get a health and safety permission, and that permission will force them to develop plans to deal with health and safety issues, then you are able to contain this problem. But we quickly realized that if you start that permissioning regime with over 1,000 mines that you have with less than 200 inspectors, they'll be sitting in the office processing this permission, and they're not able to inspect. So it wouldn't really be practical. So we inserted other sections that insist that mines run health and safety management systems, which we think will be adequate to deal with the issues around permissioning. And then moving to Honorable Gumede's question around illnesses or the death, and then nothing about disability. Currently we're developing a policy, the health and safety guidelines on how the mining sector must deal with the issue of disability management. It's a whole tricky issue. We've looked at different countries, how they deal with it, because you need a very cooperative arrangement where unions are involved. Government also plays a role on how you deal with the issue of a disability management. And it hasn't been a requirement in the law, but however, bigger companies, because they operate internationally, they have this program. We've conducted a policy study to see the effectiveness of this program. And really the problem with them was more around how they are implemented, because they were run mainly by employers. And best practice around the world is you need to involve the union when it comes to decisions, what you do with the disabled person, and we're working on a guideline in addressing the disability issue in the mining sector. And then just going to the notices and stoppages, the increase, I think I've touched on it earlier. Yes, there has been increase because there was a concerted effort. We looked at our problem. We said, we have a capacity problem. And our regulatory contact must be meaningful. We can't be going to a site, you find non-compliance, and you go, tomorrow you go to another site. When you go to a site, you find a non-compliance, you take action, because we don't have coverage. We can't afford to be going to the same place over and over again. So we took that decision last year, and we really drove the problem of issuing notices, stopping places where it's necessary. And we can see already with the decline in some areas. So really, that's what was happening. But however, one thing I thought I needed to clarify, if I had Honorable Gumede properly, when we stop mining places, we don't stop them indefinitely. In terms of our law, we stop them, we give them reasons why they are stopping, they must fix, and once they've done that, we allow them to operate. So if you stop a place now, and you come again and you find something, you can still stop that particular place. So I thought I needed to just provide that clarity.
And then there was a question, can I ask just before you continue, if I could lead on that, you know, slide 10, let's take Northwest, for instance, on stop order. 0607, there were 186. 0708, there are 309. Something that's on page five, slide 10. So the increase I'm checking is of the 186 that was stopped in 0607, are they still part of the 309? Or the 309 is new stoppage?
I hear it, Chair. Some of those mines are partly some of those that were stopped. And let me, when you look at the mine, big mine establishment, and it complicates the whole issue of coverage again. If you take a big gold mine operation, you find that mine has got, just thinking of one Anglo mine, they've got close to 100 working places. 100 working places. So an inspector can go to a working place or two and find something that he thinks is serious and stop. And then another visit, probably they went to a different place, not necessarily, because these mines are big, are really big. Then they stop. So you find that some of those mines are the same mines that are stopped for different reasons. Okay.
Sorry, I have been summoned to the Chief Whip's office. Can I request Honorable Temba to take over in the meantime? Would you please? Thank you.
I still have that open. In your app. So the notices, stoppages, and then the capacity we've addressed. Section 11, if I can just draw your attention to the Act. The investigation in terms of Section 11, Honorable Gumede, it's an investigation that has to be conducted by the employer. Even the current Act requires that. And Section 60 of the current Act requires government then to conduct investigations. And I need to clarify that. So there's nothing that stops government from doing the same investigation that the employer is doing. The Section 11 investigation is purely for the employer so that he learns what caused the problems and addresses it. And the purpose for the government investigation may lead to prosecution or whatever. And we know that people will hide facts then. And so for me, these two sections are good in a way because they focus our attention on improving conditions. Section 60, which government has to do, when you look at Section 60, it says, Chief Inspector of Mines must instruct an inspector to investigate any accident or occurrence at a mine that results in a death, or any of any person, and it details the serious illness. So these are two empowering sections. One empowers the employer, and one empowers the state to do its own investigation. What we were introducing in Section 11, we were saying that of the 4,000 incidents that takes place in the industry, we don't investigate all of them. When it comes to investigation, Section 60 gives the inspectorate discretion to look at what they are able. Because I think that the legislator, when the law was passed, the issue of capacity for inspectors has always been an issue. So if we have to investigate every little thing, we'll never do inspections. We'll only do reactive work. So Section 11, we're trying to say those that we can't investigate, then we are able to force the employer to give us their report. If we are able to learn something from it, we can distribute it. across the entire industry and people can learn from it. But that investigation is not prohibiting government to do any investigation. It was really just to say, those that we can do, can we learn something from them? That was really the intention of Section 11. And then Section 47, Honorable Zubeda asked whether we've consulted with the Department of Labor. We're talking with the Department of Labor. We have a task team. And I will take you there. In 1999, Cabinet took a decision that all inspected bodies in the country must be brought into one body. Department of Labor was the lead department. In 8 years, and that Cabinet decision hasn't been implemented. Our move was purely informed by the current problem that we see growing, that we need to deal with. But in terms of boundaries are very clear. We deal with purely health and safety at mine. Department of Labor doesn't interfere there. We deal with health and safety. In fact, we have a cooperative agreement, like issues like how trade, we work together, but there is a cooperative agreement that helps us. But there's no issue of problems with boundaries. Mining is a very specialist. Sector, so Department of Labor doesn't come into the picture. The OSH Act covers everything except mining. The mining is simply handled through the Mine Health and Safety Act.
I think there's a follow up from
Honorable. Okay. Sorry, Honorable. No, I think it's the issue about this investigation. I think earlier on you talked about the Constitution has been supreme. Now, if there is an allegation being made against the company, it warrants an investigation. Now, you cannot have the same company investigating itself. That is why I put an example that, now, after this company employs someone to investigate its actions, the next thing you see headlines in the newspaper. The inquiry and investigation clears the mining company.
Mm.
So that sits in the minds of the people, no matter then what government does after that. So that is where I think we need clarity, because there needs to be some form of independence. It's unlike when government then, because it affects people. That is why I say officials will have an open invitation for the Tyco matter.
Okay.
Because it affects a common number of people.
Okay, if I can be just addressing that specific problem, and I think we can talk about it also once we conclude it, Honorable Ganete. If you look at Section 11.5, it says every employer must conduct an investigation to every accident that must be reported in terms of this act, serious illness and health-threatening incident. However, when you go further, which I think it covers the incident that the honorable member is raising, Section 63 says if there's a cause for concern on health and safety grounds, an inspector must investigate any matter referred in subsection 2 if instructed to do so by the chief inspector or requested by the union health and safety representative. So essentially, the Act empowers the public to make that request. If we get a request to investigate a matter, then we send an inspector to do that. The investigation of 11.5 is not those nature of investigations. It's just where somebody is injured, the employers are compelled to investigate. So we can deal with the matter. And then when I move to, there was a question on corporate social responsibility. That's how I kept it. It was the Honorable Kuna. Okay. The question was really on mining houses helping communities. Although it falls beyond the scope of the health and safety, it's handled under the MPRDA, where mines have to provide social plans. And social and labor plans that talks to communities. However, the programs that we have been running from the Mine Health and Safety Council We've conducted research around feeding schemes and mines, and you know, quality of food that is offered to miners. And I know that problem doesn't extend to communities. However, I serve on the mineral and licensing board, petroleum and licensing board, and certainly that's a matter I can raise there, because the issue of social and labor plans, we handle the issues there. And then the honourable member.
Sorry, follow up on that. I thank you so much for that response. But then, I'm sorry. Because of the concern that existed about the quality of mining, if you go through your documents, perhaps you'll find that Goldfields had a training center in Dundulu near Melmoth, because the rural areas were the base for miners. And then Mangosuthu Technical was founded, particularly by DPS, to train people who would assist in the management of the mines. Because at that time we had no place where our people could be trained to assist even in the mines. So I think we could go back into our documents as to how far we can work together with the rural community. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the comment is noted. I serve in many capacities. with MQA, chairing the MQA, and I know MQA does a lot of training in those areas, and it's certainly matters I will bring before the board and also the licensing board that deals with social and labor plans to address community issues. And there was a question on CEO responsibility and what the change will do, and I'd like to answer that question by just referring back to the Act. If you look at Section 2A, it says every chief executive officer must take reasonable steps to ensure that the functions of the employer as contemplated in this Act are properly performed. And when you look at the functions of the employer, it's designing a mine in a way that is safe, it's not posing danger both to employees and surrounding communities. So, mining companies, as I said, are multinational, sometimes purely companies owned by investors. You can't really get a hold on the employer. So they appoint the CEO who takes that responsibility. And what we're seeking here is that if that person is appointed, at least we know. Because the accountability in terms of law then is carried by that individual. And our experience is that in some cases, like the case I was referring to in Rustenburg, where 9 employees were killed by gas, when we started looking who is accountable, we spent weeks trying to find out who is responsible. Because the companies are merging and you had the name of the company, but there was no individual who you could hold responsible. So this session will really help us. You need the accountable person who you know you deal with, you set papers, you ask them to do carry out certain legal duties. And then I've talked about the amendments. As I believe is that if this amendment goes through, and particularly also around the NCT, which will deal with the capacity issue, because at the PPC, initially, there was concern around agency. And the point we put across in the CPC at the time was that even if we were to pass this legislation without passing establishing the inspectors as an entity, we might as well just leave it, because we won't be able to enforce it. Because at the heart of a lot of these problems is capacity. Being able to go there, take measurements. Part of the function of the inspector is to collect data. There's a lot of intelligence, health and safety intelligence you need. And I think that question takes me back to the question of the Honorable Douglas around health issues. What are we doing currently? legislation is very clear. Employers every quarter have to take dust measurements, noise measurements, and they bring external companies to do those measurements, and they submit them to government. And we look at the figures. If they are concerning, inspectors move in, they put in corrective actions. So issue of intelligence is very important here, health and safety intelligence, and I think we have programs that are helping us to address the problem currently as we speak. We're developing a national system that would capture this information, which will make it much easier for inspectors to see where problems are and act. I think if there's a gap in terms of health and safety intelligence and knowledge management, because it's a very knowledge-intensive type of work, and you need systems that would inform inspectors where there are problems and they need to act quickly. So we're in the process of developing that very system to guide them in their action. And then the last questions which were raised by the chairperson, collusions by inspectors, I think we've addressed them. We've had quite issues around this. We've been running an investigation at the South Deep, one of the major incidents we've had recently, where 9 mine workers were killed. Unions came with accusations that inspectors were colluding with the mine, and I have stepped in and conducted investigation into the whole matter. So in instances like that, we conduct investigations, and we found that there are grounds for the complaint. We deal with the relevant inspectors in terms of the disciplinary procedures of the department. And there was a question around recommendations and setting aside. And the question here, incidentally, we had a quarterly meeting a week ago where we discussed this very information. And I was saying to my managers, looking at the figures, they're telling you a story. What needs to be corrected? Why recommended? Why so many tender plans? Because it could be, and I raised the very same question to say to them, it could be that people are bribed. It could be that inspectors are not competent, so their recommendations are very poor. And obviously, you need to develop their capacity. So those are the technical problems we're grappling with in terms of those. In my experience, because I also was a principal inspector in the Northern Cape, some of these recommendations you find, they come, an inspector has just taken a decision. When you look at supporting documents, they think it's not enough supporting documents. And particularly with this fine, mine don't take it lying down. Here's my legal team, they will tell you their offices are inundated with boxes of files where legal counsel from mines are appealing these cases. And when we look at them, when the principal inspectors look at them and think that they are not defensible, they set them aside. Because precisely if you were to take enforcement actions and you're challenging courts, and you're always losing, it's weakening your ability to enforce. And we're currently running legal problems. We're working with VET to really capacitate, to empower the inspectors in understanding how to prepare answerable things, proper recommendations that can stand in the face of challenges. So I think that's where it talks to our capacity challenges. As much as we have 92, even the 92 vacancies, even the vacancies that are filled, a lot of the people, I'm currently doing that study to see how many, a lot of the people who are in our establishment are not qualified to be inspectors. We put them on a 2-year program and trying to train them in-house. So you end up with that type of problem that sometimes they take decisions, and those are problematic. I mean, early yesterday I was meeting with one of the big mining houses where they wrote me a very ugly letter, and they had reason to do that, because the citation that the inspector wrote to them was not defensible, and they went public and said you need to discuss what the inspector said. And thinking about the implication of that, I said let's see how we deal with the damage of this without weakening the inspectorate and also taking into account your concern as a legal persona and as a citizen who also has rights. So one is actually, in terms of capacity, you always have to balance these issues. But we have problems in addressing the issue. The chairperson raised the question around Section 50, which is the last question I'm addressing, which, if I can just read it to members, the section in the B454, the initial section. Oh, it was an extension. It simply reads the inspector must impose must. I think the problem there was the must impose a prohibition on further functioning of a site where a person is dead, serious injury, health threatening occurrence has occurred by blocking, barring. And the problem there is that month. What I've indicated is that a year you have 4,000 incidences at the month. And effectively what this section says, everywhere where something happens, you must stop the way it says. There is need no discretion to inspect that. And if we look even beyond that, it will have negative consequences on the mining industry. The way the law is written now, we give it power to stop a place if it poses danger, and we must give it capacity for people to do that. And this section simply says the inspector just go stop. And it doesn't even talk to how you open the working places. And I think that's why there was a letter that comes from the industry that even said it goes into like confiscation and what was the other word? Deprivation of property and all those issues. Well, from our side, we think is that if it was a name, it needs an inspection to inspect. Currently, the way it is, it's really problematic because everywhere where something happens, an inspector must go and stop that thing. So those are the issues. The questions I think I've addressed, all the questions I've addressed, and all
the thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I don't see anything that mentions insurance covers for the miners and house subsidies. And that's something that could make the people to be retained in the mining industry. Because unless there's something that links you strongly to where you work, it is just to be jumping here and then going to other places that affect you. But that, I don't see that in the bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. It's a difficult question. But currently we're addressing that problem. I think in the public comment, Labour came very strongly on that issue. But the problem with it is that issues of compensation insurance are dealt by the Department of Labour and Health. And currently, as we speak, there's initiatives to get the ministers together and talking about how it's addressed. Because the problem here was we couldn't change other acts or impact on the duty of other ministers through the Mine Health. It's a jurisdiction issue. But currently, as I speak, the minister has written letters both to the Minister of Labour and the Minister of Health, and they will be meeting to discuss the whole issue. So there's a jurisdiction that falls under those three departments.
Honorable
Chairman,
thank you for the small correction. My surname is Chen, not yet. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any more questions, member? I don't know when I was out. Maybe there's a concern that I had. Didn't we make a practice, to go to see longer?
trained disability, it was raised. My question is, how do you, I mean, try to attract students in all provinces to make them intern, so that at the end of the day, then you give them a contract that they won't leave you as soon as they are, you know, well developed.
Thank you, Chair. The current programs that we are running, Lena Inspector program, and we have an internship program. Although the internship has got practical problem with the nature of work we do, because the current internship program, as it's run in government, is more administrative. So when we get learners, we find that all we can do is to expose them to the work environment, but they're not getting practical training. So we run those programs separate. Internship, which is mainly much more, because of our nature of work, our internship is much more administrative, and that works very well when they qualify to employ them. But on the inspector program, it's more a learnership, because there you need graduates. So we advertise, but the problem is the number and the budgetary constraint that we have. I've been talking to the Mining Qualifications Authority, and they were also going to recruit additional students for us to beef up the project, the problem.
Thank you. This is now the time that we're going to look whether we agree with the bill. And the leader, do you have anything to say?
Capital, with your permission, if I can be allowed to make some on the amendment that the department is proposing, what needs to be made on this before the second pandemic is closed.
Are they input or are they amendments?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just some input with regard to what has been presented before the committee and suggestion as to what should be changed. I will use the presentation slides that they had. I will just go through on the last part that dealt with the provisions of the draw. These are the ones telling you with regard to telling you your concerns. Chapter 2, we start with section 5, which the issue was the matter of set of facts for subject matter. On that point, there was a suggestion that we change the set of facts into subject matter. I believe the person on that, the set of facts is actually more limiting than the subject matter, which would be too wide to cover a number of things that will form part of the exclusion in section 65. Section 65, page 5. Of the details, the one with the 44 on the last amendment of subsection 5 in page 7. We have set of text there in the suggestion that we change the subject matter. I believe that subject matter is the one that is actually too wide and will cover a lot of things, which necessarily is not the intention that they even do that the section provides. I think it's safer if we wish to say that.
Members, are we together? Okay.
And then again, Chairperson in section 58, I'm just indicating a person that maybe on the implementation plan there's really not much, because the act is basically in a way a plan. But on the issue of the permit, but I'm just saying the committee may make a serious consideration onto those amendments, whether they consider to remove or leave them as presented. Otherwise, with all the other proposals, Chairperson, that is all I just said to make an input on. Thank you. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, Mr. Senegal, Mr. Senegal. I think we are now putting us on the clock. You say it's up to the committee. Am I hearing correct? It's up to the committee whether we want.
Thank
or
you,
whether Mark. We want to leave them. Can you be clear?
Yes, Professor, thank you. I'm saying, especially on the 49 proposal, the committee, I'm putting forward that the serious consideration onto those amendments, whether we remove or we retain them, the serious consideration must be placed there.
I think the ball is in your court now, in our court. Before you come in, let me hear Honorable Kameko.
I wanted to request that before they comment first, then we comment.
All right.
Because they did the presentation.
I think this is a perfect. I think on the last issue that was raised with the staff by the federal advisor, what we try to do, particularly with the removal of item B, this was a very initial amendment that we had proposed by the department, and it had other amendments, sections within the bill that talk to exactly when the permit is going to be granted, under which circumstances are they going to be drawn or revoked and all of that. This is a very powerful provision, Chairperson, that by removing those, this one was inadvertently retained in the bill. And you know, with the cleanup and the last look at the bill, we think that this one should have gone out with the other 49 and the other insertions that we have put in. And that's basically what it does. Yes, it talks a lot to an issue of capacity, but it goes beyond the capacity of the inspectorate. It's a very powerful provision that requires some other provisions that will indicate exactly when are they going to be granted and under which circumstances are they going to be thrown. And on 49L, I think there is agreement that what we are asking is the department at this stage is that, you know, the last look at the bill, that was also, it's not a provision that the chief inspector or the inspector can really put an implementation plan in place for the industry. We enforce the act, the industry must implement what's in the act. So this really is in place the way it is, and we're asking with permission of the committee to have it removed at this stage.
And if I can comment on the also on that permit, I mean this section on permits talks to nothing, because the initial insertion was removed. So if we leave it, it means nothing. It was an oversight to leave it up to the state, and that's why we just brought it to the attention of the committee of the state.
Member? Yes.
No, thanks. I think it's much more clear than that. That we as a committee, I'll comment on two issues. That now we'll take the proposed, you know, amendment, even when we go to the bill. But coming to this one, which is not part of the presentation, I'm sure Section 86 was not part of the presentation. And I think we want to say once more that we are Parliament, and we are called Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. And Parliament consists of the National Assembly and NCOP, and that no one house should be used against another. That would not allow. That if there is a structure that has had an opportunity to make presentation in the National Assembly or in the NCOP, shouldn't use another house to deal with the matter. I think we need to stress this and to say to our chairs, they shouldn't actually even bring these letters to us. Not unless they either come from the department or whatever, as part of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable
Gamete.
Honorable Mbeki.
Thank you, Honorable
Chair.
In principle, I don't have a problem with changes that need to be made. I just have a problem in the way that was brought to the committee. I think that these kind of, especially these kind of submissions need to be given prior to the meeting to see and actually see how it affects the bill and affects our input. It's difficult for me to sit now and to think through all the ramifications that these changes might have. So, in principle, I don't have a problem with these particular changes, but I just think that it's very bad the way that was brought to the committee. It needs to be brought by the committee.
Thank you, Honorable Dada. Honorable
Connor. Thank you, Chair. No, I think the input by our lawyers was a very valuable one. And I would also suggest and go along with suggestions by other members that we do adopt those amendments and recommendations. But also one wants to find out, are we, and Chair, you will excuse my ignorance, are we dealing with deadlines here? Because the concern raised by other members, it's a bit serious in the sense that sometimes we need to acquaint ourselves with these things beforehand. But that is it, as it may, I want to say, at least on the one about vicarious responsibility or liability, we need to place emphasis on that one. Perhaps even before it got here, it should have been thoroughly considered. And if it is not a case of deadlines and stuff like that, I would also propose that emphasis be placed on that one, because as government, we are sort of a broad church. We don't necessarily go with employers or employees. They are both our children, our members, and therefore no one should be criticized in the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. I think the department is a leader. State law advisors, you heard what the committee members are saying. We speak with one voice, and we as the select committee, definitely we want to think that we are recognized as the select committee on economic and foreign affairs. The National Council of Provinces exists. So even if maybe we don't meet next time or we meet other next year, you must still bear in mind that the select committee is existing. Members, with your permission, can I now read the motion of desirable that in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to amend the Mine Health and Safety Act of 1996 so as to review and strengthen enforcement and enforcement provisions to simplify the administrative system for the issuing of fines and to provide for matters connected there with. Any mover? Honorable, seconded by Honorable Gamete and Honorable Dada. Can we now go to the bill clock by clock or page by page and hear from you members? Page by page.
I propose that we go page by page.
Page by page. The majority rule. We all have before us Bill 64B of 2008 as amended by the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy of the National Assembly. Page 2.